Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Nick Blumberg. Brandis Friedman is on assignment. Here's what we're looking at. Will Illinois opt into a federal tax credit scholarship program? We hear the pros and cons. And what to know about prescription weight loss drugs as demand for them grows. First off tonight, Cook County Forest Preserve's police are asking for the public's help in identifying a sexual assault suspect. The attack of a 29-year-old woman happened in a heavily wooded area of Labaugh Woods on the northwest side around 12:30 p.m. on Saturday, according to a release. Police distributed a sketch of the suspect today. He's described as a white man about 6 feet in height with a long brown and blonde beard reaching to his chest. Forest Preserve Police, along with Cook County Sheriff's Police and the Chicago Police Department, have been canvassing the area since the assault. Anyone with information is asked to call 847-635-1188. A peek behind the curtain at the grand jury proceedings in the failed Broadview 6 case. Attorneys for the former defendants had demanded the typically secret grand jury transcripts in the controversial case after Chicago's U.S. attorney dismissed all remaining charges last week. Earlier today, a federal prosecutor said the government would not object to the transcript's release, which is expected sometime next month. After reviewing the unredacted records of the grand jury proceedings, a federal judge said she was, quote, incredibly shocked and said prosecutors had broken the trust placed in them. For more backstory on this case, check out our website. A $39 million annual tax break. That's the top line of a study from the Cook County Treasurer's Office into the proposed megaprojects bill that's aimed at easing a new Chicago Bears stadium in Arlington Heights. The analysis from Treasurer Maria Pappas's office is the first go at putting a price tag on the legislation, which passed the Illinois House last month but has yet to clear the state Senate. According to the report, the yearly savings would amount to more than $1.5 billion over the course of the 40-year agreement the bill proposes. State lawmakers are set to adjourn by Sunday, with Governor J.B. Pritzker telling reporters last week that he was optimistic the legislation would pass before that deadline. We've got more details on our website. Up next, the debate over the new federal tax credit scholarship program and whether Illinois should participate. It's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The federal tax credit scholarship program passed last summer as part of the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill could bring new education funding to Illinois students. So far, 27 states, most of them Republican-leaning, have opted in. If Illinois chooses to participate, scholarship-granting organizations could provide families with money for tutoring, test prep, and private school tuition. But critics argue the tax credit initiative is a school voucher program in disguise that could divert money from already underfunded public schools. Joining us to discuss the issue are Cassie Cresswell, Executive Director of Illinois Families for Public Schools, a nonprofit organization aimed at improving Illinois' public school system, and Bobby Sylvester, Vice President of the Urban Center, a Chicago-based organization focused on developing centrist leaders and a, quote, common sense policy agenda. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it. So, Bobby Sylvester, can you give us sort of a rundown of this program, what it would mean for Illinois students if the state were to opt in?
Sure. Well, what it would mean is that potentially billions, if not tens of billions of dollars could come to benefit the education of children in Illinois, both at public and private institutions. So our public schools and our private schools could all benefit. And the way that this works is individuals, federal taxpayers, mm-hmm. can make a donation to the scholarship granting organization, and that scholarship granting organization then uses those funds to provide educational opportunities for kids, whether that's tutoring, bus services, or private school tuition, or, you know, there's just a long list of things that it can be used for.
You know, Cassie, your organization, along with 44 others, wrote a letter to Governor J.B. Pritzker urging him not to opt into the program. What are your concerns?
As we've seen with voucher programs around the country, vouchers send public tax dollars to private schools who do not have to serve all kids, and there's a lot of discrimination issues. at private schools, especially, for example, students with disabilities. If you place your child in a private school, you're giving up their rights to a free and appropriate public education that you have in a public school. And so really those discrimination issues and the lack of oversight and transparency and accountability for public dollars when they're spent as vouchers is the big issues with voucher programs.
Yeah. You know, Bobby, what do you make of the argument that this program would be diverting funds away from public schools toward private schools?
Yeah, it's simply not true. The reality is that the federal government continues to provide funding for education, the state government continues to provide funding for education, and then the vast majority of funds come from property taxpayers at the local level. And it's important to note that the state of Illinois has never spent more money on public schools. And certainly there's a formula, the evidence-based funding formula, that calls for more. We think that's great. That should be continued and encouraged. But there's certainly the opportunity here to bring billions of dollars to public school students. And since most Illinois students are public school students, they would benefit the most if Governor Pritzker opts into this program.
You know, Cassie, as Bobby mentioned earlier, you know, families who receive these scholarship funds, they could use them for a range of expenses. You know, it could be tutoring, could be test prep. Do you think most families might use the money for those services rather than for, you know, private school tuition?
So what we know about the program so far is that states are not going to have the option to regulate the so-called scholarship organizations. That's the voucher distribution funds. And so those can be set up by essentially anyone who can set up a 501c3, and the dollars will go to whoever that organization wants to support. So there are already very large multi-state SGOs existing around the country, and those are really set up to benefit from this program, and they have the infrastructure and the advertising and the marketing. For example, Betsy DeVos's nonprofit has set up a seed fund to make sure that these SGOs that go to private schools will have a way to reach taxpayers who will then send their tax dollars to those organizations. So it's really, to the extent that it can benefit public schools, that will be in communities that can set up these sorts of SGOs. And if the state is not regulating them, I think we'll see something very similar to what we see in, for example, Chicago with Friends of organizations. The Federal Reserve Bank did a big study of those organizations back in 2023, and they really benefit the most wealthy schools and wealthy communities. And to the extent that we're going to see public schools benefit from any of these dollars, I think that's really going to be concentrated in wealthy communities too.
Yeah, what do you make of that argument, Bobby, that it's just going to help folks who are already fairly well off?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be true at all, because there's already a mobilization happening in certain areas, right, to make sure that public school students benefit as well as that low-income students benefit. And so to take the first part, you know, Dr. Stafford, someone that I've met, he's a superintendent, public school superintendent from Southern Illinois. He's already working to organize an SGO for his school district so that he can take advantage of these funds and make sure that he's capturing as many dollars as possible for his students here in Illinois. Now, for the private schools, it's generally going to be used for tuition, for the percentage that goes to private schools. And it's going to go to students who cannot otherwise afford to attend a private school. And that's what is certainly we expect to happen.
You know, Cassie, in that letter to Governor Pritzker we mentioned, your organization argued that this program pretty closely resembles the Invest in Kids program that Illinois operated between 2017 and 2023. How did that program shape your view of this new initiative?
I think the key problems with that program that we really saw were, one, discrimination. We saw discrimination against students with disabilities, LGBTQ plus students, undocumented immigrant students, pregnant parenting students, students who had abortions, policies discriminating against those students, or in some cases, staff and families, were on the books in many, many schools that were getting public dollars. So that was a huge problem. Another problem is that the oversight was really lacking, and we had a fairly well-designed program as far as voucher programs go, but we did not have exact dollar amounts that were going to each school. The breakdown and information about the demographics of students was weak. There was supposed to be annual testing during that program, and we only got testing one time and one annual report in 6 years. And even that limited oversight is not going to be present in this federal program. It's going to be even weaker. And so that really is just, you know, anyone worried about where their federal tax dollars are going to go should be concerned about that.
Yeah.
So just a couple things there. So one, it's important to note that this is a taxpayer-driven decision, meaning you as the individual get to decide which SGO that you donate to, and so you get to choose, right? So it's not that it's just going to somewhere, right? You're going to know because you have to take action to direct it to very often your local area, right, to benefit students who could use those funds.
But what do you make of that argument that, you know, critics saying this could go towards schools that are discriminating against, you know, certain classes of students, LGBTQ kids, students with disabilities?
Yeah, I think that's a red herring. I think that's inaccurate. I've seen plenty of private schools that have very different policies on this, and there's certainly federal and state anti-discrimination laws on the books, and those have not gone away, and they continue to be available for anyone who thinks that they have been discriminated against. And as much as Cassie says that there's claims of discrimination, I have yet to see an actual person who has said that.
So to be clear, the same federal and state laws that control or regulate anti-discrimination in public schools don't really apply to private schools, especially religious schools. So that means that these schools actually are free to discriminate in that way. You can go on the website of these schools and see in their parent handbooks. And you know, when you look at some of the data that the State Board of Education had, on, say, for example, special education. If you look through of the hundreds of schools that were getting private school vouchers, only about 15% of them reported serving any special education students to the State Board of Ed. So, you know, in public schools in Illinois, 100% of our schools are serving kids with individualized education programs. And that's in part because there are very strong laws. So if you discriminate against students with disabilities, where their parents have recourse to pursue and make sure that they have their rights protected.
Well, you know, supporters of this program, you know, some of the argument is that, you know, families, you know, deserve educational options beyond public schools that may be underperforming, that may have, you know, be struggling. What do you make of that argument?
I mean, one, when we actually look at the data from longstanding voucher programs around the country, they do not result in better academic outcomes, especially for low-income students, for students of color, for students with disabilities. So if we are actually concerned about academic outcomes, what we need to do is strengthen our public school systems that serve 9 out of 10 kids in our state and around the country. So that's really the important part there. Another part about this federal program that's actually different than the Illinois program, Illinois had an income level limit of just a couple times the federal poverty rate. This program has a limit of 300% of the area median income. So for the Chicago area, that means families, you know, of four making more than $300,000 will qualify for a voucher. And we've seen these universal voucher programs around the country where any child from any family can get a voucher. We've seen that next door in Iowa. And that really ends up benefiting wealthy families who are already sending their kids to private school. And that ends up being like 2/3 or more of the kids getting vouchers are in those families.
You know, Bobby, during the March primaries, Illinois voters approved a non-binding referendum supporting the state's participation in this program. Do you expect that, you know, Governor Pritzker will opt Illinois into it?
We certainly hope so. And we think that as people continue to understand this law, that there will be more and more states. So very recently, the state of New York has indicated that they are going to opt in. So that is another big Democratic state that has said that they want to participate in this program. And so we're certainly hopeful, and that is our expectation that he will opt in.
Just a few seconds left, but have you heard anything from the governor's office on this issue?
He says he's waiting for the regulations to come out. From what we've already heard from the Department of Treasury and the IRS, I don't think we can expect the Trump administration to be creating a program that is going to help public schools, because that is just not what their goal is.
All right. Well, we could spend probably the whole show on this issue, but that's all the time we have for right now. Bobby Sylvester, Cassie Creswell, thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Up next, what to know about weight loss drugs as demand for them grows. Demand for weight loss medications is growing in the United States. Recent polling shows roughly 1 in 8 adults are taking a GLP-1 weight loss drug. GLP-1s like Ozempic and Wegovy have been prescribed for patients to manage diabetes, obesity, and other conditions as an effective treatment. However, the soaring rise in popularity of the drugs has some healthcare workers concerned over their accessibility to vulnerable populations. Joining us to discuss all this, Teresa Gentile, a board-certified registered dietitian and a spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which is headquartered here in Chicago, and Dr. Laura Farrington, a medical oncologist for City of Hope Cancer Center Chicago with a specialization in breast cancer treatment. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it. I'd like to start with you, if I could please, Dr. Farrington. You know, for folks who maybe have heard about these drugs but don't necessarily know the exact mechanism, how do they work?
So GLP-1 drugs are synthetic versions of a natural gut hormone your body already produces. The GLP-1s work in multiple different mechanisms. It works in your pancreas, it works in your liver, it works in your stomach by slowing gastric emptying, which allows you to feel fuller longer and less hungry. It also works in your brain to suppress hunger and reduce food cravings.
And Teresa, I know you often recommend weight loss medication when working with patients. How have you seen these GLP-1s improve folks' conditions?
Well, many of these GLP-1 drugs have robust research behind them in terms of improving cardiovascular, decreasing cardiovascular risk, and improving insulin sensitivity. And the weight loss alone can change people's lives. It is absolutely life-changing for some people.
And I understand, you know, typically you're part of a larger team when it comes to treating patients. Why is that holistic approach important when you're prescribing weight loss medication for folks?
There are so many facets that go into weight loss, and that's not just medical. So that's the clinical supervision and medical supervision is extremely important. The food supervision is very important as well, because there's a real risk for micronutrient deficiencies. There's a risk for disordered eating behaviors that might arise. And there's a risk of other mental health issues that might come around and show its face now that people are starting to lose weight, and sometimes very quickly.
Yeah. You know, Dr. Farrington, I know there are sort of emerging areas of research when it comes to these weight loss medications, you know, their impact on inflammation, on metabolism, cancer biology. What are some of the key things we've learned so far?
Well, when it comes to GLP-1s and cancer, the data we've seen so far is very exciting, that these retrospective analyses are showing potentially improved survival, for example, in early stage breast cancer. And also a retrospective analysis showed that potentially this may be actually decreasing some of 14 of the most common cancers that we see. However, the data that we have so far are mostly through retrospective analyses. So it's really important to take what we know so far, that these drugs may be helpful in cancer. They may help people lose weight, keep their blood sugars under control, treat sleep apnea. However, it is not ready for prime time. I would not recommend a patient that has cancer to, for example, only treat with a GLP-1. Absolutely not. But in certain cases, for example, in women with obesity after they've had breast cancer, or women with diabetes after breast cancer, potentially these drugs may be life-changing and life-saving for many patients. But those are the patients I would encourage to go on clinical trials for this.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, what are the you know, questions that still need to be answered with this research for the information to become, you know, more solidified?
Yes, every drug and medication out there needs to have rigorous clinical trials, not just this drug helped me lose weight and now I don't have breast cancer. We need thousands of women to enroll in these trials so that we can figure out who are the best patients, candidates for these drugs, who benefits the most, and who should we be keeping these away from? Who are the highest risk patients? You know, these drugs can certainly cause issues like pancreatitis, eye disorders, you know, significant weight loss making patients underweight. So it is not for every person out there, but trying to figure out exactly who the right patient is that these drugs may help save their lives, that's what we're working on right now.
You know, Teresa, as we mentioned, the polling shows these medications are becoming increasingly popular. Why do you think more people are becoming interested in pursuing GLP-1s?
Well, for one, their weight loss potential is phenomenal compared to the previous generation of weight loss drugs. I mean, tirzepatide, the dual agonist, has shown up to 20% weight loss in clinical studies. Another reason is that because people are seeing that it's working for their friends and family, word is getting out. And I think even more importantly, it's bringing the recognition that obesity is a condition and we need to treat it as such. And not just inside the medical community, but outside the medical community, that obesity isn't just a facet of a lack of willpower, that it is a medical condition and needs to be addressed because there are issues of hormones and genetics that come into play with it.
And, you know, how do you think the popularity of these medications, you know, talking about some of the unintended consequences, how might these GLP-1s, you know, affect folks' mental health, you know, for people who are struggling with stigma around weight, around sizeism?
Yeah, it can be very difficult for people to, I found some of my patients, it's for them, they felt they were giving up when they took the medication, that they have struggled for so long, and it's such an important part of their identity, actually, that it's hard to say that they're going to do this, you know, or being asked if they're doing it the natural way. But, you know, being on it helps free them from some of the other issues that come along with the food. And for the first time, sometimes for the first time in their entire life, they've had control over food and what they're eating. And that can be very freeing for people. They can start to worry and think about other things in their lives other than just food.
You know, Dr. Farrington, there was a Washington Post story in recent days detailing it can be relatively easy for folks to get a GLP-1 prescription through apps, through online doctors. They reported, you know, folks with eating disorders have gotten access to them as well. Are you concerned about how, you know, easy for some folks it can be to purchase GLP-1s?
I do think it's a little bit scary how easy it is to get some of these medications and how they are coming from people that aren't in a patient-physician relationship. I think it's very important to realize that these are not quick fix weight loss drugs. These are long-term medications to help with overall survival and to help with your cardiovascular fitness. And so it is not something that you should be getting online from someone you meet that day. The other part that scares me is that a lot of people are getting compounded GLP-1s, meaning there are pharmacies that are making these drugs and compounding them with other things that don't even necessarily have to be regulated. And so there's a lot of people out there that are getting a lot of garbage that they're getting either in shots or pills that may not even resemble these drugs, or they resemble them in a way, but we do not know that those are safe or beneficial. I do encourage patients to try to get these drugs with a primary care physician who they've had a relationship with and knows their medical history, and also through real pharmacies, through places like Lilly or pharmacies that, you know, we know what is in these shots, because a lot of these compounding pharmacies or med spas, you don't really know what's in there, and you can be injecting your body with things that are bad for it.
We've got just about 20 seconds left, Doctor, but for folks who are, you know, thinking about taking these medications, what's the most important thing you'd want them to understand?
Talk to your primary care doctor about this. This is not a quick fix. This is a long-term health, goal for you. And so it's not something that you should just be getting through an online compounding pharmacy.
All right, that's all the time we have for this segment. Dr. Laura Farrington, Teresa Gentile, thank you for your expertise. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Sign up for our free email newsletter, Urban Nature, to stay up to date on environmental news, information on local wildlife, and much more. That's at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. A look at where budget negotiations stand in Springfield as state lawmakers face an end-of-month deadline. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.